Coming up next on Passion Struck.
Activation energy is something that I learned about a long time ago in a chemistry class, and it just really jumped out to me. You put, let's say, two molecules in a beaker of water and they don't react. Nothing's really happening. And then you add some heat to it and the molecules start moving around a little bit more, not really bombarding and reacting. But then you add more heat. Now they're really moving, add a little bit more heat, and now they interact, they bombard, they hit each other, and then a reaction takes place. So the amount of heat that you add to the system is the activation energy, the amount of energy that you've put into the system. And that jumped out to me because I was like, wow, this really applies to everything in my life, all the things I want to do.
Welcome to Passion Struck. Hi, I'm your host, John R. Miles. And on the show, we decipher the secrets, tips, and guidance of the world's most inspiring people and turn their wisdom into practical advice for you and those around you. Our mission is to help you unlock the power of intentionality so that you can become the best version of yourself. If you're new to the show, I offer advice and answer listener questions on Fridays. We have long-form interviews the rest of the week with guests ranging from astronauts to authors, CEOs, creators, innovators, scientists, military leaders, visionaries, and athletes. Now, let's go out there and become Passion Struck. I am absolutely thrilled today to have Dr. Jeff Karp on Passion Struck. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, so nice to see you.
Jeff, I thought we would start out by talking about your origin story. And I understand that growing up, you had undiagnosed ADHD, and that must have presented some unique challenges during your childhood. Could you share a little bit about how that experience impacted your early life and shaped your approach to learning and problem solving?
Absolutely. Yeah, it really shaped my entire life and pretty much almost, I'd say, every moment of my life right now. When I was in the second grade, nothing was really sinking in. I wasn't able to keep up with the material. My mom tried flashcards. She tried phonics. And I just wasn't getting anything. I wasn't socially connecting with anybody. And I'd sit at the back of the class, frustrated, angry, feeling demoralized, and just pretty much like an alien. Like, I didn't belong there. And then at the end of the year, the teacher pulled my parents aside and said, hey, I'd like to keep Jeff back to repeat the second grade. And my parents negotiated with the teacher so that if I spent the summer with tutors catching up, that I'd be able to go on to the third grade if I made enough progress. And so all my classmates went on vacation, and here I am in summer school. And I go in every day. And I remember one particular day that I went in, and the tutor read a passage. I answered some questions. Then she looked me straight in the eye and she said, how did you think about that? And nobody had ever asked me that question before. And I was like, it was like a shocking moment for me because I didn't really know how to answer that question. And I think almost like the pain of the moment, not being able to just be my impulsive self and just say what was on my mind or what I was thinking and didn't have a response, it all of a sudden, it was like this light bulb moment, this flash of awareness that I could actually think about thinking. And today I look back and see that was my first sort of experience with metacognition, with this idea of just having awareness of my thoughts. And so what happened right after that, it wasn't anything dramatic that immediately happened, but this newfound awareness I started to bring to everything. And just one example is I would be in class and very few things would sink in. I'd have a very difficult time keeping up with anything, which was very frustrating being in class. And then actually in college, it was similar too. I stopped going to classes because I found there were more effective ways that I could learn just on my own. But back to the third grade, what I noticed is that when I asked a question, I had this moment of hyper-focus where I could listen right after that question was asked, and that would sink into my mind and I could connect it to things that I knew and I could remember it later as well. And so I figured out that asking questions was my way of learning, that I had to ask a lot of questions. If I didn't ask questions, I just wouldn't be able to process anything. And it also really, I found it as a tool to slow things down, to slow down a conversation. People say things, even to this day, people will in a conversation, if I don't ask a question frequently enough, I miss a lot of what people are saying. I can't keep up. It's not fast. My brain doesn't work that fast. And so it was like this canvas open to me to be able to almost like, it was like the start of my life as a living laboratory. So experimenting with all sorts of different things, pattern awareness of my own thoughts, my own actions, observing other people and how they react to things and how they act and what they say and the questions that they ask and what the responses are. And I just started to become hyper-focused on that as a way to learn and to experiment. And I would just say a lot of my life has been trying things out that are not me. So it's almost like I need to try things to determine what's not me, to figure out what really is me, live these different experiences and live these different ways of being, and then get in touch with my feelings. And is this really me? Because I feel I can do that well, but I don't know unless I try it out and road test it.
Yeah, I love talking to researchers. And for those who are listening and don't understand the different areas of research, there's in-lab research, there's field research. And then I love it when I talk to scientists and researchers who talk about me research, because I can completely relate to your journey as a kid. I didn't have ADHD. I suffered a traumatic brain injury when I was 5, and it caused a number of side impacts, including auditory processing issues. So for me, being in a classroom was just devastating because that was not how I learned. And that has proceeded all throughout college. I hate lectures because I learned by doing and by either visually seeing it or having to read it. I also had a lot of cognitive issues that came about with it. So similar to you, my own me search was vital in helping me to cope with this new life that I inherited from this injury and having to move beyond so that I could perform as much as a normal person as I possibly could. How do you think that this me search inspired your role into getting your PhD and this path of bio-inspired innovation that you found yourself in?
What happened was, so after I had this kind of light bulb moment, really, I still was struggling a ton. And it really wasn't until the 7th grade when things opened up for me, because the school system didn't want to do anything about it. They didn't want to investigate. And my mom actually prepared this massive file on me and went to the school board herself and brought the case. And then they identified me as having learning differences. And that was this incredible moment, because I'd been developing all these tools and trying to do pattern recognition and really try to clue into what works for me and how can I really fit in and get by and survive. And so my grades actually went from C's and D's to straight A's in the 7th grade. I also had a very inspirational teacher, which I think also played a major role in that as well. And I actually became very interested in medicine. And I saw myself as, I wanted to become a doctor. In fact, in my early years, the teachers would ask me, what do you want to be? And I'd say a doctor. And they'd say, you better set your sights lower because you just don't have it. Like I got a lot of that. I feel like a lot of kids get those comments of, you're lazy, or I got that, or you're just not going to amount to much. I had a lot of feedback like that. But what happened, I was so excited about medicine. And flash forward a bit, I was at McGill University. I was in the chemical engineering program. I applied to 3 medical schools and I got rejected from all 3 schools that I applied to. And it was like these moments that have happened a lot in my life. I feel through experimentation, you've set yourself up for, I don't know if I call them failures. It's so easy to just use that word, but setbacks, or just, it's almost like it sends you into the self-reflective mode. And I realized that those modes are really like that. That's the time. It's almost like an after the rain moment, or when something's happened, you almost expect something to happen a certain way. It doesn't happen that way. You're emotionally charged. But 2 or 3 days after, I've realized this, there's this pattern where the emotions subside, this opportunity for looking back and analyzing and doing a little bit of detective work and just being open to these insights. They just start coming. And I started to think, well, wait a moment, here I am. in engineering, I really liked the problem-solving aspect. I really liked medicine. I was like, maybe there's a way I could combine these together and I don't have to be a doctor to do it. And then what happened next was I was at this 24-hour coffee shop in Montreal near McGill, and I overheard some classmates talking about tissue engineering and engineering organs and tissues and drug delivery and all sorts of biomedical engineering things. And I said, well, what are you guys studying for? I didn't even know there was a course like that. And they said, oh, there are these grad level courses that you could take as an undergrad in your final year. So I went to the course director and I said, hey, I'd love to take these courses. And he said, no. He said, you need 3 physiology prerequisites to take these courses. And I was like, come on, it's my last year, next year. He said, no, you have to do that. So I called my parents and I decided to spend an extra year at McGill. So all my friends graduated. And here I am taking 3 physiology prerequisites so that I could get into these tissue engineering and biomedical engineering courses. I had done a couple summers of research earlier with bacteria, which I liked. And so I took these courses, and that's what really set me on course to getting into the field that I'm in today, where essentially I define my laboratory as we focus on the process of medical problem solving. So my life through this me-search, I like how you said, I've never heard that before, but I love that term. This me-search, which I've done my whole life, I just feel like I've really, to do that, I've had to really engage processes and systems and really test things out. And what I love about medical problem solving is that it's really about trying to understand how people have defined problems and how can we take steps forward to learn something that others haven't learned yet that might be critical to prying open a new opportunity or new shot on goal at this some sort of medical problem. And that's what we focus on now.
I had a different question I wanted to ask you, not prepared at all, but it just intrigued me to ask this. I have had a lot of doctors on the show who are talking about the need for personalized medicine or functional medicine. Because right now the medical system, because of how payments are done, really focuses on the protocols that you need to put in place, which in turn really creates a system where you're looking at the leaves or branches, meaning the symptoms, rather than the holistic being or the person or the tree. How have you approached the research that you're doing? Are you looking at it holistically, or do you look at it more in those subcomponents?
Well, we look, I would say, very holistically, in the sense that, I'll just give you an example. I've figured out that the most effective way for me to run my laboratory is to minimize the overlap in expertise of the people in the lab. And for example, we have engineers, we have biologists, immunologists, we've had a gastrointestinal surgeon, a cardiac surgeon, we've had a dentist in the lab. It's constantly changing. But it's this sense that if we can, I kind of envision, if we're sitting around a table brainstorming a particular problem or solution, everybody can provide a unique perspective if you're minimizing the overlap in expertise. Everybody has ideas, ways of thinking, tools at their disposal or that they know how to use, knowledge that others don't have. And so to me, that's a very holistic way of approaching problem solving, because I think a lot of the problems that we work on require lateral thinking. They require taking information from different fields and combining them together, weaving together like a kind of mosaic of knowledge and skills and tools and approaches, ways of doing things. And so that has been really fundamental in my laboratory, I think, to make progress. And I think it's one of the major reasons why almost every major project in my laboratory, we've been able to spin out into a company and then be able to bring multiple products into clinical trials and a number on the market as well.
Yeah, and I was very keen to understand Harvard and MIT, for those who aren't familiar with Boston, and Cambridge sit right next to each other, probably a mile apart from each other. What has allowed you to be able to work at each institution?
Well, first of all, I'd say in Boston, you need to have at least 3 affiliations for people to take you seriously. So I have 5, just in case I lose one or two along the way. So my home institution is the Brigham and Women's Hospital. So I'm right in the hospital, which is critical because the team, like, we're constantly interacting with patients. Like, we're seeing patients every day. So we're very proximate to the problems that we're trying to solve. My academic appointment goes through Harvard Medical School. So where I'm, they say full professor. That's just the title. I always get a chuckle out of the word full. Like it was, what was I before? A full professor. And then I have an appointment at MIT through the Health Sciences and Technology program. And then I also have an appointment at the Broad Institute and the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. And so I see these affiliations as access to resources, access to being able to tap into core facilities and various equipment and also people. It makes it really easy to go walk in the door and collaborate with people. And again, it goes to your previous question, which is this kind of holistic approach to solving problems. The way I look at it is that we need to be able to access as much knowledge from different places and tools from different places and ideas. And also another reason why we've had over 30 people from over 30 countries in the lab, because people are subjected to different education systems. They think differently. And I think all of these things just are critical. So that's how I do it. I've taught courses at MIT. I'm engaged in mentoring students as well. And so the grad students who've been in my laboratory have come from MIT.
Well, that is awesome. And thank you for sharing that. It made it a lot clearer for me to understand how you have all these different affiliations. And I love that you work in the hospital primarily so that you are getting that in-person research that's being done. So today, Jeff, we're going to be talking mostly about your brand new book titled LIT, which stands for Life Ignition Tools. The subtitle is Use Nature's Playbook to Energize Your Brain, Spark Ideas, and Ignite Action. And as you and I were talking about before we came on, I love this because I found so many parallels in your work in this book and the work that you do overall to the work that I do in Passion Struck. And my subtitle is Unlock Your Purpose and Ignite Your Most Intentional Life. And for me, ignition is an extremely important aspect of intentionality because I equate ignition to your intrinsic motivation. Because if you don't have that, you're not going to ignite action. And I utilize a process I call deliberate action process that has six steps. And the third one is ignite. And people ask me all the time, why would you have ignite as a step in this process? And I said, because once you've analyzed something and you prioritize what you want to get done, if you're not igniting your inner energy or that of a team to actually do it, you're not going to execute it with the enthusiasm and rigor and energy that you would if you don't have that ignition spurring. So I thought it was important to maybe have you describe what you mean by ignition and its importance.
Absolutely. I love what you just said and that you think a lot about ignite, because I think that we need to tap into motivation to create momentum and to really move forward in the things we really want to get done. And so for us in the laboratory, for example, there's a lot of problems that we want to work on, but I think there's also a lot of aspects of human nature that we're up against, right? In terms of, I think if we go back 10, 15,000 years ago, when we were all hunter-gatherers on the savannah, the goal was really to conserve energy and to use our energy very purposefully for survival. If we needed to move to another location, or if we needed to hunt or run away from something, for example, in some ways, I feel like our brains are wired to not initially be motivated to do things that don't involve survival. And so in the lab, we're trying to solve medical problems, and we need to find ways to motivate ourselves and to maximize our potential to gain momentum and remain persistent towards these goals. And so I think one part of it really is being in the hospital, seeing the patients. That really keeps us, that helps, that kind of adds, that kind of fuels to the fire. And I think that other ways that we think about ignition is often we may just stay in the drum rolls and we don't actually take that first step forward. And the drum rolls are important, or we're like planning, we're thinking about things. But sometimes we're like hesitant to start experimenting because we never know, just like the fundamentals of research. You don't know what you're doing is going to work out. And in most of the time, it doesn't work out. And so there is hesitation there. And so to me, the ignition is really just doing enough planning, doing enough thinking, and taking a step forward and believing that step is going to unlock some insights that you can't get unless you take that step. And so to me, that's really the essence of ignition, is thinking about, we have a lot of hesitation, a lot of fear to take steps. And I just find that if we believe, the more we can believe that first step is going to help us uncover an insight or some sort of knowledge or teach us something that we didn't know, it's going to unlock something by just taking steps, even though we're taking steps into this unknown space. And to me, that's what really ignition is all about.
Yeah, I like to think of it this way. I'm not sure if you're familiar with self-determination theory, which Edward Deci and Richard Ryan created up at University of Rochester, but basically says that humans have three psychological needs: autonomy, competence, and relatedness. Autonomy means that we all have a choice and we willingly endorse our behavior. Competence refers to this experience of becoming a master of one's activities, and relatedness is really the work that Bob Waldinger does around feeling connected and the sense of belongingness that came out of the Harvard study of adult aging. But when I think of competence, in order to achieve mastery, you really have to have that constant ignition to stay motivated to be effective in anything that you pursue. Do you look at it in a similar way?
Yeah, I look at it in a very similar way. And I think even, I would say, coming back to the word holistic, I think, for example, to me, it's all about having that the courage to take those first steps, knowing that you might not get where you expect to go. You often don't get where you expect to go, but having the courage in knowing that you're looking backwards in your life and saying, okay, things have worked out in many ways. And it's like, sometimes we just need to believe that, okay, we have some fear about taking a step, but if we can just step into the fear, I think that's where we end up getting a lot of key insights. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not, but that's where my mind is going at this moment. But yeah, feel free to bring me back on track here, because my mind does wander and jump around. So,
well, Jeff, I'm going to bring you back to the title of the book, because we hear something like lit, and you describe it as a state of heightened awareness and engagement. But I was hoping you could describe for the audience what lit means to you and what lit could mean to them.
Yeah. So lit to me is really that spark of inspiration, that infusion of fresh energy into any moment that we all have access to. It's really the ability to tap into what's in all of us. There's just so many examples. It's like when you're talking to somebody and all of a sudden you become a little curious, like that's lit. Or if you look up at the night sky and see the ocean of stars and you're in awe, that's lit. If you are following your passions, that's totally lit. Lit to me is, it's about really looking within to uncover these opportunities that we all have to just embrace this energy transfer of life, which is, there's just so many things in my life where lit has just been so instrumental in just connecting with people. Like, I'll give you an example with my children. Actually, maybe I'll go back and just tell this story, because I think it's just really fundamental to the whole lit premise, which is, when COVID hit, my life literally crashed down in my living room, because I had been focused my entire life on efficiencies and productivity, really almost like overswinging to compensate for these learning differences and the ADHD. And I was always up against time. And so I was looking for patterns, looking for ways to be more efficient, be more productive. And it was almost like this endless cycle, because I just kept becoming more and more efficient and more productive. And I became a workaholic. I became addicted to the dopamine hits, and I just couldn't get enough of it. And so when COVID hit, all of a sudden we had this unintentional pause, and it just hit me. I looked up and my son, this kid, is now in high school and a teenager. Like, he's the quarterback of the football team, and my kids just stopped coming to me. I was going to birthday parties and I was trying to network with other parents who are there, during the birthday party because I was just so focused on my work. At the games, like soccer games or whatever it was, I'd be walking around the field just trying to get my steps in, like everything super goal focused. And it just hit me that what was most important to me, I wasn't prioritizing. And while things were going extremely well with me at work and in the lab, at home, it was a completely different story. My wife and I, our relationship had deteriorated. It was like ships passing in the night. We just weren't really talking. And I noticed this inner desire for possibility. And this really gets to one of the core tools of Lit, which I call flip the switch. And so I noticed there's this possibility that I'm not engaging in. There's another way of doing things. And a second step of flip the switch is to consider it takes stock of what's working and what's holding you back. And I realized that I was really being held back by just being impulsive towards and just focused on my work. And so what happened was the third step is considering other ways of thinking and other possibilities. And I started to look around and it was right there in front of me. My wife was exploring various aspects of spirituality. There's some questions that she was exploring. And I was like, Jessica, can you please introduce me to your teachers? And to me, that was the step. That was the key step that I had to make. That was the lit step. It was seeing that there were these possibilities that, and with the, it was living, like figuring that was the step towards intentionality, right? There wasn't intentionality in my relationships. There wasn't much of it until that moment when I decided to take the step to engage. And I started to meet with these spiritual leaders and I started to just ask questions and explore and try to keep an open mind. I had previously experimented with meditation, but I didn't really find anything that worked. But then at this time during COVID, I actually found transcendental meditation. It's this one word that you say over and it just helped me get into this observer mode and see how impulsive I was. But I started to be able to see that I would, these ideas, let's say an email would come in for work and I would just jump on it right away and try to respond. And I've got to get this done immediately. Or someone asks a question, just jump over there to answer the question. And I'd just be jumping around. And I noticed in my mind that these things would actually subside. Like my desire, my sort of that instant sort of pull to do something that if I just waited, it just faded away. Like I could actually watch it fade away out of my mind. And so I started to bring this energy to my family. And I'll give you an example. When my children are speaking, I noticed this desire to just interject and say something, to shift the energy from them to me. And what I did was that in this sort of meditative mode, I was like, okay, let's just let that pass. Let's keep the focus on my children to support what they're saying. Because it's rare, first of all, for a teenager to be speaking to their parents, I think, in certain ways. And so I just needed to just pause because what I felt like saying in the moment really wasn't as important as I felt in that moment. It would just pass. And so to me, that was, and my relationship with my family started to improve from that moment. And I put all these guardrails and things up. And to me, that's one of the core essences of lit, is noticing the inner desire for possibility. It could be in anything, relationships, it could be in works and self-exploration, it could be in being more creative and curious and tapping more into your passions and anything really. But it's like noticing there's this inner desire for something a little different and then figuring out what that step is to take and then just taking that step. Even knowing whether you don't know whether it's going to work out or not, but the step is almost like in an experimental way. You're going to learn from it. You're going to grow from it. You're going to have new insights. And it's always worked out that way for me.
Yeah, I often say that the most difficult step or choice you have to make is the initial one. And that's the one that holds so many people back because they're so afraid of failure or self-doubt or the consequences of it that they don't end up taking it. Do you find that to be true in your research as well?
That's absolutely true. And I think that to me, we're hesitant, we're fearful of the first step because we have an expectation associated with it. We expect a certain result. And the way I think about it is that if we flip it to expecting a result from that, to more of an expectation that you're going to learn something. I think it's okay that there's going to be some insight. There's going to be some piece of information that's going to come to you and that you're going to think about and that is going to add to the puzzle. It's going to add to the system. It's going to inform you in some way. I think if we shift from expecting something positive, like some goal, to achieve some goal, we shift that to learning, even just something tiny, just this little thing, this little piece of information, I think then we're more likely to take those steps because the focus is not on something that is high risk. It's something that's actually very low risk. And to me, that's what we've done in my lab is switch from the high risk, like expecting something which is high risk, to believing something will happen which is actually low risk. And that thing happening is just learning.
I want to go back to your introduction, and I'm actually going to read from it, because what you're talking about here, I think, is something that we fail to often see. And that is, many of the people we consider to be trailblazers or luminaries have had catastrophic failures in their lives. And the difference is that they take the action that we're talking about, and it takes them in a completely different direction. So I'm going to read this. You write, some people assume that they don't have what it takes to be highly creative and focused, or to maintain a high level of productivity, discipline, and engagement. All too often, people believe the lie because of messages they received at an early age. Type famous people who failed into any search engine, and you'll quickly learn that educators considered Albert Einstein to be a poor student, and that Thomas Edison was addled and not worthwhile to keep in school. Walt Disney was once fired because his boss thought he lacked imagination and had no good ideas. And one of Oprah Winfrey's employers told her she was unfit for television news, not to mention all the negative things that happened in Oprah Winfrey's life from being raped and other things at an early age. And you mentioned this in the topic of mining your neurodiversity. What do you mean by neurodiversity?
I think that everybody is on some sort of spectrum. I think we're a collection of our sort of genetics as well as our experiences, and we all have unique ways of thinking about things. And I think that sometimes, because we as humans have such a need to have a sense of belonging, we kind of gravitate towards wanting to be the same as others and connect with everybody. But I think that neurodiversity is just such a beautiful thing, because if we were all the same, life would be so incredibly boring. We just wouldn't learn. And that's, to me, like, that is also like the essence of how my laboratory is structured, is like maximizing the diversity in thought, diversity of the origin where people came from, diversity in experiences that people have had and the ways that they think. And so to me, neurodiversity, it's about just the beauty around how all of our brains are wired differently and how we respond to things differently. And the reason I say it's beautiful is because it just presents this opportunity to constantly learn about other perspectives, other frames of reference, to look at things in different ways. And it's like you could have a plant and have 10 people look at the plant, and they're all sort of processing it in different ways. You think that everyone's processing it like you're thinking about it, but everyone's thinking about it differently. And then if you start having conversation, what do you see? People are going to start talking about different things that they're experiencing. And that is inherent, like that's part of the learning process. Curiosity is like a fundamental core source of energy for everybody. And so to me, the neurodiversity is something that unlocks our curiosity when we are in a room with other people, just because everybody's having different experiences and there's just so much to learn from each other.
Well, I want to take you now to activation energy. So we've been talking about this need to take this first action, and then after that, many actions after it. And I like to say that you have to learn how to align action with ambition and aspirations. And you do this by being intentional. So there's a graph in your book where on one axis you have energy, on the other axis you have intentional action. And you've got this stick figure who's pushing a boulder kind of over a hill. And it's this activation energy that needs to be consumed in order to do it. When I describe this in my words. To me, it's as if your car is broken down on the side of the road. And this is before we have cell phones, and you're left with two options. Either you can stand there and be a victim and raise your hand and try to flag someone down, or you can choose to take intentional action and to start pushing the car forward. And when you do so, initially, it's going to be extremely difficult. But the more you put energy into it, this activation energy, it starts to roll and you start making progress. Is that a way to think about how to lower this activation energy?
Yeah. So activation energy is something that I learned about a long time ago in a chemistry class. And it just really jumped out to me, because this sort of traditional way of thinking about it is you put, let's say, two molecules in a beaker of water and they don't react. Nothing's really happening. And then you add some heat to it and the molecules start moving around a little bit more. They're not really bombarding and reacting. But then you add more heat. Now they're really moving, add a little bit more heat, and now they interact, they bombard, they hit each other, and then a reaction takes place. So the amount of heat that you add to the system is the activation energy, the amount of energy that you've put into the system. And that jumped out to me because I was like, wow, this really applies to everything in my life, all the things I want to do. If I want to go, for example, to ride my bike, and I haven't ridden my bike in a long time, then that could be a very high activation energy. And this actually happened to me last summer. That's why I'm bringing it up. But for example, a friend of mine called me, Michael Gale, who was actually over yesterday. We're like co-working together. And he called me last summer and he said, being on his bike is his happy place. And immediately I thought, it's my happy place too, but why am I not riding my bike? We're right starting to get into the middle of the summer. And I thought, okay, if I decide to try and go ride my bike today, I'm just going to set myself up for not doing it and then shaming myself and get into the cycle. In fact, I feel like people practice not achieving their goals because they set the goal to be too high. Then they don't achieve it. They shame themselves and it makes it even more harder to achieve goals. And so what I did was, is I said, okay, I'm going to break things down to lower the activation energy. So the first thing I did is I cleaned up my bike. I hadn't used it a year or so. Next day, I was like, I'm only going to do one thing a day. I'm only gonna let myself do one thing a day, because that actually builds up the momentum and that kind of pressurizes the system, right? So the next day I put air in the tires. I'm like, I'm not going to allow myself to do anything else. And so I'm building the momentum, the desire to ride the bike is now building, and that's lowering the activation energy as well. And then I hang my helmet on it. I put the bike somewhere where I'm going to see it every single day. And so now all I need, now the pressure's built up because I'm excited to get on my bike. I know I can do it, but I'm like holding myself back just a little bit. And all I need is like 15 minutes to get on the bike to go around the neighborhood a couple of times. And that's what happened. And last summer I biked over 1,000 miles. And so I think that for hardcore bikers out there, I'll say, okay, that's not a lot of miles, but for me, it's a lot, going from really not much. I ended up almost biking every day in the summer to work and back, which is 4 miles or something like that. And I do bike rides on weekends, and it just actually led to all this fresh energy in my life. But that to me is a key example of many I could give, where the idea is, how do we define in just a qualitative way, or just think about like, how much energy is it really going to take me to do X? And then to say, is there a step that might reduce that amount of energy? It's really just reframing, taking steps towards a goal, but thinking about it in terms of the amount of energy that you need to exert. And I just found it's been like an incredibly useful way to approach life and new things that I want to do, because it helps to really, it helps me to identify those big steps really will require a lot of energy, and that it helps me clue into the fact that high energy step I'm unlikely to crack with one shot. Like I need to make multiple shots to make this happen.
Yeah. Well, I love that story because I'm a huge cyclist myself. In fact, I rode 20 miles this morning, with the cloud cover we had today at 5 o'clock in the morning was very dark. But I like it because there's not that many cars on the road, where typically here in Florida, we have a ton, which can get pretty scary, given that I don't think many motorists like bicyclists. So I want to move on to your chapter on live for the questions, swap caution for curiosity, And you emphasize in this chapter the vitality of inquiry. And as I was reading it, it reminded me of an interview that I did with my friend, former Navy SEAL Mark Devine, who's got a great podcast himself. And before he became a Navy SEAL, he got really introduced to martial arts and through that mindfulness. And he came to the conclusion, and I love when he told me this, that the quality of your questions determine the quality of your life. In the context of lit, why is asking the right question so crucial?
Wow, questions have just been so crucial for my entire life. And I would say that one of the reasons I think that we have such a hard time asking high value questions is because we've all been shamed at some point in our life for asking a stupid question, right? And what that has done is that it also, it creates like a stigma around asking questions, fear or hesitation. A speaker gets up and we have a question. We're like, well, is this really a good question? Or what will people think? We hold back. And so not only has that prevented us from asking questions for later in our life, but it actually has prevented us from getting better at asking questions. Cause I really feel asking questions is a skill. And I'll give you an example. When I entered grad school at University of Toronto, I would attend these invited speaker seminars that would happen. And I'm trying to pay attention. I'm trying to my mind's wandering. And then we get to the question answer period. And all of a sudden the arrows start flying. 3 o'clock, sweater vest, boom, like a question just right to the heart of what the speaker just asked. And another arrow, like the arrows just keep flying. And I'm like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. These questions are just incredible. And then I thought to myself, I don't have any arrows. I don't have any questions. And I didn't even own a sweater vest. And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, how can I felt this talk about inner desire for possibility. I thought, I really want to learn how to ask questions, these really high value questions, but they're not coming to me. And even though I'd spent my whole life like iterating and trying to figure out the best questions to ask. And I used to play chess with my dad when I was younger. And if you look at like an amateur chess player versus an expert chess player, the difference really is pattern recognition. The expert chess player is able to see 12, 13, 14 moves ahead or something like that. And so I started to think, okay, maybe there's some patterns here because again, I'd been involved in like engaging in processes my whole life. And I'm was at the point where I knew if I'm not good at something, it's not because I'm inherently not good at it. It's just because I haven't engaged the right process that works for me. And I've just applied that concept everywhere throughout my life. And so I said, okay, well, what can I do here? So the next lecture, everybody's there to hear what the speaker's saying, but I'm there for something else. I'm there to listen to the questions. And so what I did was I wrote down all the questions that people asked at the end of the seminars. And after a couple months, I thought, okay, now I'm going to look through them. And I started to look through them. And it was like an aha moment because I noticed patterns. I noticed that there were 4 or 5 categories to the questions that people were asking. One big category is the experiment working. Did they set it up correctly? Do they have the right controls to show that it's actually working properly? A lot goes into setting up an experiment and a lot can go wrong. Another set of questions had to do with importance. If someone's trying to develop a diagnostic for blood to detect something and they've done all their experiments in salt solution, saline, then the results may not yet be important. There were a lot of questions around statistics as well and a few other things. So all of a sudden I was like, wow, I figured out the motivation behind why people were asking the questions. Next lecture, I go in and it's like I have my detective hat on. I am laser focused on what they're saying because I'm looking for holes in their presentation. I'm writing down the questions that come to my mind. All of a sudden, I feel myself even become more creative because I'm thinking critically about what they're saying. I'm thinking of next experiments they might perform. I'm thinking of where their technology might be useful to apply next. And so through this process, I was able to figure out how to ask better questions. And I feel we can bring this, like the power of the question, it's like the best technology that we have at our disposal because it can help us solve a problem. It can help us to connect with people more deeply. It can help us to unlock, to problem solve, and to think about things from different angles. These questions have just been so fundamental to everything that I've done in my life and at my lab.
Well, I completely agree with you. And I think that quote from Mark is a great way to remember the importance of these questions and asking them throughout your entire life, because for him, it helped him to realize that he was meant to be a warrior, not a tax consultant, which he was at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and it changed his whole life trajectory. And he continues to ask them on a regular basis. And I think that is so key to all of us to do.
Actually, one thing just to add to that is, so my postdoc mentor, Bob Langer at MIT, he once said that in school, we're judged by the answers that we give, but in life, we're judged by the questions that we ask. And I think that, to me, that's so true, is that the education system, we're just giving answers. If you think of the format of tests, imagine what it would be like if tests were what questions would you ask versus what answers, what are the answers? I think that it just in my life, it really comes down to the questions. And some of the greatest breakthroughs that have ever occurred in science are from people who asked questions in different ways, who asked the question that no one else had asked. And it just pried open a completely new field, a new avenue for research.
Well, thank you for that, Jeff. And I wanted to just go to two more areas before we end up. One is your chapter on Pinch Your Brain, Attention is Your Superpower, where you really go into discussing the interrupting distractions that we all face in life. And I loved something that you talked about in this chapter, and I'm going to just quote it. In the 1971 book, Computers, Communications, and the Public Interest, Nobel laureate Herbert Simon wrote, and again, this is 1971, "Hence, a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention and a need to allocate that attention efficiently among the overabundance of information sources that might consume it." And I, in my own book, wrote a chapter on conscious engagement. And in it, I described that the vast majority of people are living, whether you want to call it spontaneously engaged or subconsciously engaged. We often hear the term autopilot, and I don't think it's the right analogy, because when you're on autopilot, I think we're still going in a positive direction. I think too many people are living life like a pinball, where we are so consumed by these distractions that are all around us that we are completely unintentional in our actions. And I think it's something that you cover, that contemporary life isn't solely to blame. It's how we ourselves are interacting with this life and choosing to undertake actions that are facilitating us to live this life the way we're doing it. So from your perspective, how does someone break free from this?
Yeah, there's a lot that's happening. I think that there's a lot of complexity to all of this. And one is, it's just like our primitive wiring, right? In terms of how for tens of thousands of years, we were hunters and gatherers, and our brains are really wired for survival. And we're meant to be able to look at the horizon, and we detect something different, we're going to hyper-focus on it, and it could be a potential threat, or it could be something important. And I think that, flash forward to today, there's $900 billion a year is spent on marketing to hijack our attention. And these cues and pings are coming at us from all directions. We have a knowledge information overload. And I'm all about technology, and I love it. And I feel like there's so many positive ways to use it. But for whatever reason, our culture, our society is such that we've allowed this fog, this cloud to just exist around within everybody's mind. And it's what's happened, I think, is that the large corporations and such are really controlling what we believe is important. And I think what you're talking about, intentionality, is really where you sort of look within to identify what are your core values, what are really your feelings about things. Like, how do you feel when you wear certain things? And I'm not talking about clothing. I'm talking about when you make certain decisions that have been almost predetermined by the forces to be, the external forces. How does that really feel? And I feel that we all get these cues from our minds. Our bodies are very intelligent. People around us are constantly giving us cues. And when we start to detach and untangle the web, and we start to really look within and be open to these cues, we start to realize that a lot of the decisions that we're making are not decisions that are in alignment with what is truly important to us. And so to me, to break free from that, we need to have tools. We need to have strategies because we're up against a lot. We're really up against like massive powers, $900 billion in marketing. And we're letting it happen. Like it's everywhere with like billboards and spam mail and just all over the internet, everything. And so I think to break free from it, I think part of it is just sort of acknowledgement and recognition of what we are up against and that these powers are extraordinarily strong. And these poles, there's a lot of gravity there. And so to me, that's part of it. Another part of it is experimenting with things that will allow us to be open to the cues that we all have available to us. So in Pinch Your Brain, I talk about early childhood experience that I have, encounter with a bat, where all the thoughts in my mind basically were squeezed out because I saw this bat in, as I was walking home along this driveway. I was out in the, lived out in the country. It was like a 1,000-foot driveway walking home, and this, our driveway was carved through a forest, and there was this bat. My mind is drifting all over the place. I see the bat and every other thought gets squeezed out. And it was like my brain was being pinched. All I could think about was the bat. And I started thinking, okay, well, maybe I could bring this to other areas in my life. And I think that at any moment, we can change what we focus our attention to. And one simple way to do it, just to give an example, is let's say when we're eating, we often eat these days where we're like on our phones or we're watching something or we're engaged, even in conversation, we're engaged in conversation. And we're not that good at multitasking in terms of like, it's hard to experience, we talk about the five senses, it's hard to experience all five of them in a very focused way. Usually it's like one, maybe two that we can experience. But as soon as we have a lot of sensory coming at us from all directions, it's just, we're not really getting that much. So when we're eating, if we intentionally say, I want to taste the flavors of the food that I'm eating, and you set that as the intention, and you start eating and you chew a little bit longer and you're thinking about the flavors, then you can really experience it in a different way, in a deeper way. And to me, that's one of the ways that we can start to become more intentional, is we can say, so to me, when I do that, then I'm not going to look at my phone because I've set my intention as being, I want to experience the flavors. If I say, I don't want to look at my phone, that's a really hard intention to stick with because it, I don't know, just to me, it's not that meaningful to me. I'll just keep picking it up. But if I say, I really want to get in touch with the flavors, then picking up my phone is going to go against that intention. I can't achieve that. And so I think there's a lot of things that we can do in our day to break free from this cloud, from the fog, to disentangle. Another thing, I'll just give one other example, is one of the chapters or tools is press pause. And to me, I just noticed that there's this tendency in my day to just have back-to-back meetings. And I can do that all day long. I could easily, every single day, I could have back-to-back meetings. I could get home. I could eat my dinner. I could then just work and have more emails are flying and everything like that. And I get to the end of the day, I'm like, wow, I really feel like I've been busy. I really feel I accomplished a lot. But the problem is that what I notice is that it actually holds me back from doing my best work. It holds me back from moving the needle in the most maximal way in everything I do. And what I've realized is that I need to make time in between the things that I do. And I'll give you an example. So if I have a meeting with somebody and we're, you know, in conversation and my mind's open, I'm listening. And if they could say things that could connect to other things I know, like people will say things and I'll think, oh, well, actually, maybe I should introduce that person to this person over here and they could work together. Maybe we could all work together on a new project and that could lead to something. But I'm not going to think about that unless I pause and have time to reflect. And I'm not talking about pausing and going on my email. I'm talking about pausing, like going for a walk, just letting my mind wander and drift around that interaction I just had. And so to me, that's one of the ways that we can intercept this pattern and we can break free to be more intentional. And we can bring this to any moment, and it doesn't take that much effort. It's just cluing into that we have this possibility, we have this potential to do it. And again, you could look out your window. It's just a really simple example. You look out your window and trees and sidewalk and everything, and you could say, okay, I'm just going to pay attention just for a moment to the bark on the tree and the pattern of it. And then you're harnessing your attention. You're cluing, you're actually intentionally focusing on something. I'll give one other example. So one thing that I do is when I walk around my neighborhood with the dogs, I cycle through my senses. So I'll say sight, And I'll look at the trees and I'll look at the pattern of the bark. I'll look at the leaves. I'll look at the animals moving around, the squirrels and the birds. And then I'll say sound, and I'll just listen for the rustling of the leaves or the birds chirping. And then I'll say touch, and I'll feel my heels hit the ground. I'll slow down a bit and I'll get more in touch with the feeling of my feet hitting the ground, the wind hitting my face. And I find that as I do this, it's like resensitizing my aliveness, my ability to experience the world and to observe. And I just think, so there's so many things that we can do in our day to break through and to be more intentional.
Yeah, I love that explanation. I do something similar. And in fact, this past weekend, my fiance and I were up in Chattanooga in the mountains and on this nature walk, and you could actually taste the difference in the air between how clean it was up there in the mountains compared to where we live here in the Tampa Bay area. It was just amazing to see the difference of all these toxins that are getting into our bodies. So I just wanted to highlight two things that you talked about. So the first comes out of your chapter, press pause, protect time to be and behold. And that is this whole idea of white space. And if the listener wants to get more information on that, I did two interviews a while back. One was with Dori Clark, the other was with Juliet Funt, where they both talk about this concept of white space. Juliet Funt actually wrote a whole book on it. The other thing that I think you really touched on was this whole concept of focus. And to me, one of the best ways I have utilized is Stephen Covey's matrix, where you look at what is important versus urgent against his four quadrants. And that's another thing the audience can look up in addition to what you taught them. So the last thing I wanted to cover was nature plays a really profound role in your book. And your second to last chapter is Hug Nature, Revitalize Your Roots. But I want to go back to an earlier portion of your book, and you write that nature holds the deep circuitry of our embodied intelligence, the complex evolutionary smarts derived from our species' constant interplay with our environment and a multitude of sensory experiences. And then you further say that we need to recognize the powerful mind-body interconnectivity, and to some degree have extended that understanding to include the interconnectivity of mind, body, and spirit, and that all we have left to do is to recognize that each of these domains is grounded in nature. Can you explain that a little bit more? Because I thought it was really profound.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've had so many profound transformative experiences in nature. And I think that, but I've also had experiences where I go out into nature and I don't feel connected. And when that happens, that is a signal of how far I am attuned from the rhythms of life. It actually shows me how much work I need to do to get back, how far my sort of being submersed in technology has taken me. And I'll give a couple examples. When I was in the third grade, I mentioned I moved out to the country, and literally I'd wake up in the middle of the night, there'd be a pack of wolves on my front lawn going next door, which was like a 15-minute walk to the sheep farm for a late night snack, for example. There was a buffalo farm across the road. We had a creek that ran across our property, and there was like snapping turtles and all kinds of crayfish and things like that. And so I would get off the bus because I was out in the country, so I'd take the bus to school. I get off the bus coming home and I just would be so frustrated. My mind just racing, ruminating on the challenges of the day. And I remember, distinctly remember, as I walked along this driveway carved through the forest, and I'd just be looking at the trees and the leaves and animals, I just felt this sense of solace, this like I was being hugged by nature as I walked home. It always helped me feel better. And there's a lot of data now to support scientifically that when we spend time in nature, it actually helps us switch from the sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system. So essentially moving from being like having anxiety and stress to lowering our heart rate, lowering our blood pressure, lowering our breathing rate, having an increased sense of wellness. And I think that it goes deeper than that because in nature, there's so many nuances. We actually had somebody come into my lab, Vivek Ramakrishnan, who I talk about a little bit in the book. Actually, it was one of these things in COVID, I started to bring spiritual leaders to my lab because it just something just felt like I needed to do that. Like people who were exploring mindfulness and meditation and various elements of spirituality. I interacted with Vivek and I asked him to come to the lab and talk about his practice. And that soon evolved into his passion, which was impermanence. And his practice of impermanence was really noticing everything around us is changing in various ways. And how, if we look at the human constructs in our lives, if we, let's say, we spend most of our time in our houses or in our workplaces, what to me is really crazy is we look around and the wall doesn't change very much. Like, we keep things very clean. We have HEPA filters. We keep nature out. That's like one way of looking at it. So in these human constructed environments, like, not much is changing on a daily basis. You go out into nature, everything is changing, right? That's a huge contrast. And those nuances in nature. So what we did in this, we engaged in this permanence project that Vivek led from my lab, where we would go out into nature and we'd find something, like in just our backyard pretty much. And you'd find a tree or a plant or a flower, or whatever it was. And you go to take a picture of it. And you just pause for a moment and you think about it. Just focus your attention on it. You pinch your brain, right? To look at that flower, whatever it is, you just pause. Instead of, we're so quick to just take pictures, but we just pause to connect, just to experience it in a little bit of a deeper way. Then you hit the button, take the picture, and you come back the next day, you take another picture, and you compare them, and you see that they're completely different. Like, their shape, they've grown, they're pointed in different ways, there's new things that have sprouted. And so it's like getting in touch with the nuances. There's so many nuances in nature. And I feel like one aspect of sort of our current society is that, like, we're focused on human made products and technologies. It's all human constructs. And so we're in this world where we're not able to see nuances. We're training ourselves to not be able to detect the nuances, because things that humans make don't really change that much, right? Like, my laptop here hasn't changed much, right, over time. But if it was made out of plants, it'd be changing all the time. And we're meant to pick up on these things. That's what really, I think, fuels our curiosity, is the nuances. And then the other thing I'll say is that this interconnected mindset, that everything depends on everything. And it's hard to see that in our current way, like, that we live life, our current way of being. Because again, we're so far detached from nature. Like, we're born in hospitals where there's HEPA filters. We spend our life in houses and cars and buildings. And then when we die, we go into coffins where life can't even get in. It's like, I don't know. I just look at it from that perspective. But when I think about the interconnected mindset, I'll just give you one example. So I learned recently from a world-leading water filtration expert that over half the oxygen that we breathe is actually from the phytoplankton in the ocean. So these sub-millimeter creatures are producing oxygen, that most of the oxygen that exists in the air is from that. It's not from trees. It's actually from the ocean. And so this sense of, like, wait a moment, my survival is dependent on these sub-millimeter creatures in the ocean that, like, I never see, but they're there. And so it's given me this, like, appreciation, this gratitude for how everything is connected, how everything is working. And I feel like once we start to appreciate that, once we start to realize that everything depends on one another and that we're not this isolated being that is just conquering the earth and doing whatever we want, and we're the center, we're the focal point, but that we're all contributing to and depending on everything else, I feel it really just helps to connect all of our minds and bodies together. Like, we are all connected, but the way that we're living our lives now, we're training ourselves that we're not connected. And I think it's a big problem. And I think it's contributed a lot to the loneliness epidemic and a lot of the anxiety and depression issues that we're seeing.
Yeah, well, it's creating a sense of unmattering in life. And what you're saying is really profound. And really close friend of mine who's a retired NASA astronaut told me that all the astronauts who've been up there experienced this thing called the overview effect. And for him, when he went on the space shuttle the first time, it was like such a novelty just to be up there that he didn't really get the sense the first time. But on the second trip, he went to the International Space Station and he was looking at the cupola and they were going over New York City. And he just imagined himself being one of the drivers in those cars who was getting so angered by the traffic and everything else. And he said it made him realize how small and insignificant that is to the interconnectedness of the universe and the role that we play in it. And to your point about microorganisms in the oceans, that's a major reason why climate change is so important, because the whole ecosystem is changing and those microorganisms are dying off, which means our air supply is. And I think people don't look at how these underlying things interact and are interconnected to each other and how all of this creates imbalance and shifts. Well, yeah. Jeff, I really enjoyed this interview today. We could have talked for a couple more hours. What is the best way for a listener to learn more about you?
I have a website, just my name, jeffkarp.com, Karp with a K. And there you can find information about the book. You can access content that's not in the book. I also have a description of some of the projects that are currently ongoing in my laboratory. And in addition, my mom has just been such a huge supporter of mine and really helped me navigate, especially early on with the challenges in elementary school. I'm going to have a part on her site. Don't have it there yet, but I'm going to add it for her to showcase some of her poetry because she's been writing poetry in the last couple of years. And it's really been like her way of really just creatively expressing herself. And her poems are really beautiful. So you can also find my mom's poetry there too.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today. It was an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed this conversation.
I thoroughly enjoyed that interview with Dr. Jeff Karp, and I wanted to thank Jeff, Alyssa Fortunato, and William Morrow for having them appear on today's show. You're about to hear a preview of the Passion Struck podcast interview that I did with Dr. Stephanie Estima, the renowned expert in metabolism and neurology. Dr. Stephanie is known for her groundbreaking work in optimizing human potential, and she'll share her insights on how to harness the power of your body's biology to achieve peak health and performance.
When you are experiencing a symptom like many of them that I've described in perimenopause, the brain fog, the energy, the water retention, the body composition changes, these are just ways that your body is trying to talk to you. So rather than being punitive and saying, God, I am broken, this stupid body is not doing what I want, instead being more of an agent for change for yourself. So what does the symptom mean? And what can I do about it that's within my control?
The fee for this show is that you share it with family or friends when you find something useful or interesting. And if you know someone who might themselves want to learn how to become lit, then definitely share today's episode with them. The greatest compliment that you can give us is to share this show with those that you love and care about. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so that you can live what you listen. Until next time, go out there yourself and become passion struck.